Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back. Today we're doing a deep dive into something pretty fascinating, an art form that, well, it really shapes how we experience movies, but it kind of works best when you don't even realize it's there. Film music.
Yeah, the film score. You've sat through countless movies, felt all those emotions, excitement, fear, sadness, and chances are, if the composer did their job well, you barely noticed the music itself.
That's the strange thing, isn't it? The core paradox.
It really is, and that's what we're exploring today, using Catherine Kalanick's book, Film Music, Narrative, Emotion, and Conventions. Mm-hmm. Basically, our mission here is to give you the tools. The analytical toolkit, you could say.
All right, so you can move from just sort of passively hearing the music.
Exactly, to actively listening to it. Yeah. And when you do that, you unlock this whole other layer of storytelling in cinema. It's pretty amazing.
Kalanick's central idea is really compelling. Mm. She argues film music isn't just background noise, you know, or like emotional spice sprinkled on top.
No, not at all. It's integral, a narrative force, an emotional engine in its own right.
And the key part, the bit that really gets me, is her point about its power lying in its invisibility. It works best when we aren't consciously aware of it, when we're not translating its language in our heads.
Mm-hmm. So the big question is, what is this invisible language, and how do we start to, you know, understand its grammar?
Okay, let's unpack this.
First off, to really get the depth here, you need to know a bit about Catherine Kalanick herself. She is a distinguished professor, English and Film Studies at Rhode Island College.
What makes her perspective so valuable, right?
So it's her dual expertise. That's the key. She knows musicology like the nuts and bolts of composition, harmony, theory, but she also knows film history, film theory, film criticism. She bridges those two worlds.
And that's huge, because for a long time, film music was kind of looked down upon, wasn't it? Dismissed by serious critics as just, I don't know, cheap emotional manipulation.
Exactly. Lowbrow stuff. Kalanick was really a leading voice in changing that, in moving film music study from the fringes into serious critical inquiry. Her earlier work, Settling the Score, was foundational there.
So she's decoding how music affects us, but on an unconscious level.
Precisely. She connects the dots between very specific musical choices, maybe using a minor key or a certain instrument like a lone trumpet, and the psychological, even cultural effects those choices have on us as the audience.
It's almost like she's teaching us how to read the composer's mind. Is that the goal of the book?
In a way, yeah. It's a comprehensive guide. It treats film music seriously as this sophisticated art form, a language with its own grammar, its own syntax, its own vocabulary that's been evolving for, well, over a century now.
And this whole framework helps tackle what she calls the inaudibility problem.
Right, that's central. Why, if music is so powerful, do we mostly just hear it rather than actively listen?
Because it's designed that way.
Pretty much. The most effective scores often work subconsciously. So Kalanick is essentially teaching us how to turn up the volume consciously on that hidden layer of meaning.
Okay, so to start analyzing this language, she gives us a really crucial distinction right up front. Diegetic versus non-diegetic music. Can you walk us through that? It seems fundamental.
Absolutely. It's the bedrock, like you said. So diegetic music is basically any sound, including music, that exists within the world of the film.
Meaning the characters can hear it, too.
Yes. Think of a song playing on a car radio or a band playing at a party in the movie or even someone humming a tune. It's part of the physical reality of the scene.
Okay. So non-diegetic is the score, the music only we hear.
Correct. The non-diegetic score, sometimes called underscoring, is purely for the audience. It comments on the action, it steers our emotions, sets the mood, maybe hints at something to come, foreshadowing.
Got it. That split, what's inside the story world, what's outside, seems like the first big tool for analysis.
Definitely the most useful starting point.
Now here's where I found it got really interesting. Kalanick pushes back against the whole idea of the silent film era. She says they were never truly silent.
Not at all. That's largely a myth. Music was always there, and it was already doing complex narrative work even before they figured out how to sync sound to the picture.
We picture that lone piano player, maybe improvising, but you're saying the reality was more structured.
Oh, much more, especially in the bigger theaters. It was a whole industry. They had libraries of existing music, sometimes full orchestras, and crucially, the studios often sent out cue sheets.
Cue sheets, like instructions.
Exactly. Detailed instructions for the musicians, telling them what kind of music to play and when. You know, play something suspenseful here or switch to a romantic theme for the embrace. It laid all the groundwork for how music would later function in the sound era, character themes, emotional cues, all that stuff.
Which brings us right to the era that codified that language. The classical Hollywood score. We're talking the 1930s, the 40s. Who were the key architects here, and what were their main techniques?
Well, you have some real giants. People like Max Steiner, think King Kong, Gone with the Wind, just massive scores. And Erich Wolfgang Korngold, who brought this lush, almost operatic style, especially to adventure films like The Adventures of Robin Hood.
And they established the sort of rules of the game, right? Like using a big symphonic orchestra.
Yes, the symphonic sound was dominant. And also this idea of wall-to-wall music.
Wall-to-wall, it sounds constant.
It often was. The music was nearly continuous in many films. It served a purpose, though. The goal was total immersion, creating this seamless, coherent, fictional world. The music was like an emotional guide.
An insurance policy, almost.
Kind of. If you weren't quite sure how to feel about a scene, the music was right there, telling you explicitly. It smoothed over any potential ambiguity.
And the big technique they really cemented was the leitmotif.
Ah, yes, the leitmotif. Absolutely crucial. It's a short, recurring musical theme or phrase that gets associated with a specific character or maybe a place or even an abstract idea.
Like the theme for Tara in Gone with the Wind.
Exactly like that. Or think of the shark theme in Jaws. Just two notes. It allows the music to communicate things independently, to tell its own story alongside the visuals. It can signal danger before you see it or reveal a character's inner thoughts.
But that very seamless romantic style didn't last forever. After World War II, things changed. We get the modernist challenge. Why did that happen? Did the old style just not fit anymore?
Pretty much. The world felt different, more complex, maybe more cynical. Sweeping romanticism felt, well, out of step with stories about psychological trauma, urban grit, moral ambiguity.
So how did the music adapt?
Composers started moving away from those big, lush melodies. They embraced dissonance, fragmentation, different kinds of instruments. A huge thing was the integration of jazz.
Jazz. How did that work?
Well, not as background party music, usually. Think of Alex North's score for A Streetcar Named Desire. The jazz elements there aren't about fun. They signify the city's heat, the psychological tension, the kind of moral decay of the characters. The music itself started to sound unstable, mirroring the themes.
You can't talk about modernist disruption without mentioning Bernard Herrmann. Especially his work with Hitchcock.
Oh, absolutely. Herrmann was the ultimate rule breaker. If the classical score aimed to comfort and guide, Herrmann's music often aimed to unsettle, to create anxiety.
Like in Psycho, I read somewhere he only used string instruments for that score. Was that just budget or?
It was partly budget. Hitchcock was famously tight on that film, but Herrmann turned it into a radical artistic choice. Using only strings gave it this incredibly stark, cold, almost shrieking quality.
A shower scene.
Exactly. Pure rhythmic slashing, no real melody. He used repetition, sharp dissonance. It completely shattered that classical promise of emotional resolution. Herrmann's scores didn't just support the film, they often commented on it, sometimes ironically, becoming part of the film's psychological fabric, part of the instability.
That's a huge shift. Music becoming an active participant, even an antagonist sometimes, not just support.
Definitely. Then later, you get this interesting swing back with the neo-romantic revival, think John Williams.
Star Wars, Jaws, E.T., yeah.
Right. A massive conscious return to the full orchestra, the big themes, the leitmotif. It proved that the old grammar, that classical language, still had incredible power and resonance with audiences.
But technology also changed things, didn't it? Synthesizers came in.
Oh, hugely. You start getting electronic scores like Vangelis for Blade Runner, and then digital sampling and technology led to the modern hybrid score, where composers seamlessly blend traditional orchestra with electronic textures, synthesized sounds. That's pretty much the dominant sound today.
So it's this constant evolution, but you can still hear the echoes of Steiner's rules and Herrmann's challenges and scores today.
You really can. The fundamental principles endure.
Which brings us nicely to the core takeaways from Kalanick's work. What are the big ideas we should hold on to?
Okay, first theme has to be that invisibility paradox again, her core insight. Music is mostly overheard. Its real strength lies in its ability to shape our feelings and perceptions without us consciously analyzing it.
Which makes it potentially quite a powerful ideological tool, right? If it bypasses our critical thinking. Did she talk about that?
Oh, absolutely. Because these musical codes, you know, soaring strings mean heroism, minor keys mean sadness, fast percussion means danger, they're culturally learned, we absorb them. So a composer can use these codes to make an idea feel natural or inevitable.
How so?
Well, imagine a complex, maybe morally gray, historical event. If you score it with unambiguously heroic, uplifting music, the audience is sort of emotionally conditioned to accept the action as purely good before they even get a chance to think critically about it. The music sells the feeling.
Wow, okay. That's quite powerful. What's the second theme?
Genre as musical grammar. Kalanick really shows how musical conventions define our understanding of genres.
Like, we just know what a horror movie sounds like.
Exactly. That dissonance, those sudden shrieking sounds, or lush strings for romance, pulsing rhythms for action. Music doesn't just decorate the genre, it helps construct what the genre is. And filmmakers play with this. They either satisfy our expectations, giving us that familiar feeling, or they deliberately break the rules for shock or effect.
Makes sense. And the third theme moves away from the composer as a lone genius.
Yes, the theme of the composer as collaborative artist. This is crucial. We tend to romanticize composers, but Kalanick reminds us of the industrial reality. They work under huge constraints, tight deadlines, shrinking budgets, directors with strong opinions, studio interference.
So the artistry is also in navigating all that.
Precisely. Finding powerful musical expression within those pressures is part of the craft. It acknowledges that film scoring is part of a complex, collaborative, commercial system.
You know, something else that struck me was her focus on silence. She has this great line, something like, "The absence of music in a film is as significant as its presence."
That's a fantastic point she makes. Silence in a scored film is almost never accidental when the music suddenly cuts out.
Yeah, you notice it immediately.
Right. It creates tension. It can emphasize realism, maybe draw your ear to a really important line of dialogue or a specific sound effect. It's a deliberate choice, and sometimes it's more impactful, more jarring than the loudest crescendo.
So we're learning to listen to the sounds, but also to the silences. Okay, we want to get practical about listening actively. You mentioned Steiner and how he made complex musical ideas feel natural. Could you break down a term like thematic transformation simply?
Sure. Think of it like watching a character change over the course of a movie, but hearing it in their music. Thematic transformation is when a composer takes a character's main theme, their leitmotif, and alters it musically to reflect what's happening to them.
How would they alter it?
Well, maybe the theme starts out bright and heroic in a major key. But if the character becomes corrupted or faces tragedy, the composer might shift the theme to a minor key, slow down the tempo, maybe use different darker sounding instruments, or distort the melody itself.
Ah, so the music tracks their emotional journey.
Exactly. You feel the character's fate changing through the music, sometimes even before you consciously register it from the plot or acting.
That really clicks. Okay, so wrapping this up, what does all this mean for us, the listeners, next time we're watching a film or even just scrolling through social media?
Well, the big application is enhanced media literacy. Once you start understanding these techniques, you become a much more critical viewer or listener. You start noticing how music is used strategically everywhere to influence you.
Not just in movies.
No, absolutely not. Think about advertising that swell of music when they reveal the product. Or news reports, how often does ominous music underscore a story about potential threats? Political ads, it's everywhere. Kalanick's framework helps you decode how you're being guided emotionally.
And beyond being critical, it just makes watching movies better, right?
Oh, definitely. It shifts viewing from passive consumption to active appreciation. You start noticing the little things, how a theme subtly changes, the choice of a specific instrument for a character moment, the way silence is used adds a whole new dimension to the experience. It's like learning a new language.
What surprised me most, thinking about it, was just how deep that classical grammar runs, how composers like Steiner managed to make really complex musical ideas feel so inevitable, so right for the screen.
It's true. They built a remarkably resilient system. And maybe the final provocative thought, the thing Kalanick really drives home, is that those powerful emotions we feel when watching a film aren't somehow innate or universal responses to the music itself.
They're learned.
They're culturally constructed. We learn to associate certain sounds with certain feelings through decades of exposure to film and media. So when you feel that tug at your heartstrings, understand that you're not just passively experiencing a story, you're being guided expertly by this sophisticated, carefully built, and often invisible language.
The takeaway is pretty clear then.
Yeah. Start listening actively. The score is telling you more than you think.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.